You're listening to WSHC Shepherdstown. This is Joe Gray, and this is Seven Generations Radio, and welcome to the show. It's stopped pouring out there, and I'm here with Sammy Brown, who is the nominee for the Democratic Party to be a delegate West Virginia to the West Virginia House of Delegates for Jefferson County. Good morning, Sammy. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And I want to get right to the subject. Now, we're going to be talking some about climate change as the show progresses, but I want to start off talking about the aftermath of the Democratic Convention and kind of what your take on it is for the Bernie supporters and the things that turned them on and the reasons that they supported Bernie. What's going to happen with their movement?
Sure. So, especially in the state of West Virginia, which is basically where I'm going to focus this commentary on, is that we had two extremes. If you want to call them fringe candidates, you can, but they seem to be the most popular with West Virginia voters. So on the more conservative side, you did have Trump, but then for your progressives, you had Bernie Sanders. And Bernie appealed to so many people because we have for a long time been grasping for straws, so to speak, for in West Virginia, whether it's wages, whether it's, you know, crippling debt, health care, especially in my age demographic, we're struggling with paying back student loans, or if you're applying to be in school, you can't get the financial aid you need, and in some cases, you're considering not going to college at all. So here's a man that spoke to all of these things and with such passion and fervor, and it wasn't exactly something that had been considered by the traditional platform. Him being wildly popular in West Virginia, we, at least from what I could tell, folks didn't understand why his campaign didn't come to fruition. They weren't understanding why he didn't win. And it went the full spectrum from math and actual political commentary to the conspiracy theory. And I think what it is they saw a man that was very different from their political landscape that they were accustomed to coming forth and their hopes being dashed, so to speak. So I think what it means now for the voter is all of those things that he stood for in this very progressive man, this very progressive platform. How do we implement that now, and how do we make sure that our government actually represents those interests?
And to what extent do you see the Hillary campaign carrying those things forward, and not only in name but in real interest and fervor?
Sure. The thing is, and being a Bernie supporter, and you know this, Joe, I'm a very adamant Bernie supporter. I had a hard time getting on board with the Hillary campaign, too. I did. It's not that I didn't think she was a smart and formidable woman. It's just that she didn't have the same passion that he expressed. And I think that was a lot of our concern for those of us that had to transition for the Democratic ticket. Now, obviously, I will. I feel like she is going to be the right woman for the job, especially in this cycle. What I would advise then is for that particular campaign, make sure that your interests are heard. I did pick up where she was looking for debt-free college, that she did want to make sure that health care was available for all, and she did want to continue to reform ACA so that it was applicable to everyone. I think that there's so many ways that she is trying to pick up all folks from across the spectrum and unify the party, and I respect that. But what people need to understand is she's a very different person. She's more of a pragmatist, and she's going to be very analytical. She's going to pick apart numbers, and she's going to be a little more common sense that doesn't necessarily portray impassion sometimes. And I do think that the media has got it in such a way that there is a distrust for her as a candidate, which doesn't play well when the field of voters has already said to you that they don't necessarily trust their government.
And what do you see, Bernie? What do you see his role? And How do you see his people in terms of their willingness to get on board? How many are going to fall by the wayside, not vote, or vote for somebody else? And how many are do you think are going to join the Hillary campaign?
That's, Joe, that's a fantastic question. And the reality is, I'm not sure. If you take a look at how folks are reacting, some of their comments online, you do see folks that are getting, that are willing to jump behind Hillary Clinton because, you know, she is taking up issues that are pro-choice, that are pro-LGBT, that does want to be inclusive of the working family. And so they see that and they feel that they can support her. But then there's others that no matter what you say, no matter how well, actually, I thought she articulated it very well during the DNC, but no matter what that message has become, they aren't willing to jump on board. I think what they can do, however, if it's not at the top of the ticket, you have a local grassroots movement that was very much the base to Bernie, and you can put that to work for your local candidates. And that's, that may be a selfish statement coming from me, seeing as how I am running from the House, but it's very true. Those of us that are running for local office, state office, your progressive change can start here. And if you had that kind of passion, you're willing to put that kind of work into a man at the very, very top of the ticket, you can see your influence localized if you're willing to put the work in. And that is a message that I do see the Sanders campaign taking going forward, is that they may have, obviously they're going to liquidate their campaign, but they can take the resources and putting into local candidates. They want the Senate on a national level. They want congressional seats. For us in the state level, we need to pick up House seats, and we want to flip the Senate to where we're in the majority. And that's how you can start to see and feel that change that you were looking for and you were starving for in the presidential campaign right here at home.
So you can see this movement holding together more or less at the local level and the state level, even if it doesn't stay together on the national level.
At least that would be my vision for it. Whether you choose to do so or not, that's a different story. But I feel that would be a fantastic use of such an amazing growth and an amazing grassroots movement that was put together in truly an accelerated period of time.
What do you make of the continuing support for the other side, for the Trump campaign, when this is a man who has no government experience and has so many negatives associated with him, has a very high negative coefficient from the populace, and yet is right now, at least even with Hillary, what is it that's driving this support?
I can speak to a state level, Joe. The way I see Trump personally, I can't subscribe to it. I can't say that I would back the man, but I do try to understand my community and my constituents, and I try to understand the psychology behind it. And I think it goes back to a root cause of mistrust of government. And when you have a man that doesn't come from your constructs and confines of traditional government, they are more likely to fall in line behind a man that seems very brash and very open and very very direct. What I will say, though, is I feel like that's a facade. I don't feel like that's actually substantiated. And I really want folks to understand that it takes action to change government, to make things work, especially for us in West Virginia, especially for working families. And will that translate? And I don't have the faith in that man that it will. What does kind of I don't want to say upset. What concerns me as far as folks that did follow the Bernie movement and may transition over to Trump is I felt like they saw personality traits, again, rooted in passion, that they can relate to on both sides. But if you were going to back a man that was probably the most progressive candidate we've ever seen and just had this amazing following, probably second to Obama, you can't possibly transition what he believed in and what he stood for to a man like Trump. They're completely juxtaposed.
Mm-hmm. What do you think is going to happen in terms of voter turnout? Do you see that the passion that brought the Bernie supporters to the voting booth is still going to be there? Are people going to turn out? And how about on the other side? Are the Trump supporters going to turn out?
I do think the Trump supporters are going to turn out. What I will say as far as the Democratic Party, well, actually for both major parties, is there is a very palpable discontent and a divide for both sides, whether it's your traditional conservative Republicans and now the new brand of Republican, which I personally find to be very extreme. And then there's us in the Democratic Party, which you have some that veer more left and more progressive, and then others that are more of a moderate. And right now there's a bit of a disparity. So if there's not a way to unify, then you are going to lose your base and you are going to lose folks, and that will result in lower voter turnout. And I think it's the responsibility of people, leadership in your community or even leadership in the party, to make sure that you're unifying, that you're grabbing those people, that you're telling them you're not left behind and we still do represent you. If you don't grab them, we will have one of the lowest voter turnouts in a presidential year.
Wow. Do you maintain ties and connections with, say, the Democratic Party as a whole in West Virginia?
Mm-hmm.
And what is their calling right now? What is their initiative?
Sure. I do. And that is coming from someone that is a newcoming candidate that again, I veer more on the progressive and left side of things. But that being said, I do feel that the motivation behind the party is, it was hard to ignore when folks came out in droves at the state convention to push the most progressive platform we have ever seen. You can't ignore that, and that is the voice of the people. If you don't consider that, if you don't act on that, you will lose the folks that had become motivated and activated in this particular election. With that being said, now they have to find the messaging and they have to find the way to make sure that they're getting people involved to push that agenda forward. If you want debt-free college, if you want a pro-choice agenda, if you want to make sure that working families have a prevailing wage, that they aren't in a right-to-work state, if you want to make sure that mine workers aren't fully displaced and can go to sustainable jobs or even technological jobs or clean energy jobs, however you want to transition a dwindling miner movement, how do we do that? And you can't do that without people. So now it is their responsibility to grab folks to make that go forward.
And now, beyond what's going to happen in your district, which is, I would say, fairly progressive district, how do you see the state as a whole in terms of progressive versus conservative?
I think it depends on how the candidate reaches out to their community, to be very fair. And mind you, Joe, in Charlestown and Ranson, I would say that I have about equal parts of Democrats, Independents, and Republicans. It's a very diverse mix. And so That poses a bit of an interesting challenge for me, having the values and beliefs that I do. But at the core of it, it's still about making sure that West Virginians survive and thrive, that we have a way for you to be here, and you are a skilled workforce, you're a sober workforce, you're a sustainable workforce. And, ooh, we have a phone call.
Yeah, I'm guessing this is Sudhir Shukla.
Sure.
Let me bring him on board here.
Sure.
Sudhir?
Yes.
This is, you're on the air. This is WSHC Radio. And I'm here with Sammy Brown, who's a West Virginia delegate, candidate for the House of Delegates on the Democratic ticket. And Sudhir is an outreach specialist for the D.C. chapter of Biodiversity for a Livable Climate. So we're going to switch gears here a little bit. We've been talking about national and state politics, but Sudhir, I'd be interested in your take on what has transpired at the Democratic Convention.
I guess overall or specifically related to climate change?
Well, let's take it on the overall at this point. I mean, were you in the Bernie camp, or where did you sit in terms of politics?
Yeah, I was definitely in the Bernie camp, but I'm behind Hillary Clinton now, that she's the nominee.
Mm-hmm.
I think the convention brought up many important points in terms of inclusiveness and pointing out issues that were missing or not well addressed by the Republican National Convention.
Okay, and on since we're going to be talking about climate change and particularly carbon sequestration and cattle grazing, when Martha Holdridge calls in, I wanted to hear your perspective on where politics is going presently in relation to climate change.
There are some obviously, so Republicans are reluctant to even talk about climate change and admit that there is a human impact. But there's some positive movement in that regard. Recently in the House, there has been established a bipartisan Climate Solutions Caucus, which now has 8 Republican members as well as 8 Democratic members. So there is some movement going on slowly, but I think there is a recognition that climate change is an issue we have to deal with. And there are slowly people, Republicans, speaking about it and talking about the urgency of taking action. And also there's in the House, there's Chris Gibson in New York State, is a Republican, has introduced a climate resolution saying that as conservation is a conservative principle, we need to, climate change is real, we need to address it, and we need to focus on solutions.
Sammy, I believe the Democratic platform from West Virginia had some pretty strong wording in defense of climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And was there an anti-fracking position taken there?
Yes, there was, which I was really, really proud of. And a few of us actually from the Eastern Panhandle were very proud of that. We had really pushed for anti-fracking as part of the platform. So we're hoping that we can put that issue at the forefront, because for whatever reason, it just doesn't seem to be taken seriously throughout the state. And I'm not sure if it's because, you know, we seem to be so familiar with extraction industry or however, but it is something that will permanently affect our state. And we have so many natural resources that could be contaminated with fracking. And we want to make sure that we can keep the integrity of business, but then also our natural resources that can be put into to sustainable energy as well.
Well, you always, when you talk about fracking, you always get the flip side of that, which is the jobs question.
We always do, yes.
I would be interested in hearing from both of you about what are the alternatives in terms of jobs when you talk about other ways of defeating global warming.
Mm-hmm.
I feel pretty confident there's an awful lot of jobs that could be developed to basically save a sustainable planet, to keep the human beings and a bunch of other critters alive.
Sure.
if we were willing to, get to work on it.
I think for the state of West Virginia, that comes in 3, maybe even 4 investments, which would be in hydro energy, solar energy, and wind. So so you have three that would be there. And then as far as a technological infrastructure to make sure that you have a digital base for e-commerce that could put other folks to work and kind of get them away from these particular industries. The flip side to that, and this is the pushback that we commonly get, is we're so used to coal and extraction industries. Doesn't that take away from those individuals? So my pushback for that is that, yes, I am pro-coal miner. I believe in working families. I believe in the hard work that you've put into it. However, if the industry is declining, I have to make sure that you have a way to transition out of that industry. Or how do we make that industry safer and cleaner? And how can we implement some of these other things to keep you at work but keep you safer? And that's really, if you want to call it a dilemma, Joe, that's where we are right now, is how do we transition to make sure that those families keep their base, keep their integrity, and we can still utilize these other forms of energy, which will only put us in a better place economically, I feel.
And Sudhir, I know you've worked quite a bit in the area of carbon sequestration. Would you explain what carbon sequestration is and what it's... Why it's important?
But if I might add on a little bit to what Sammy said,
please,
regarding jobs, et cetera.
Yeah. Go right ahead.
Or would you like me to focus on carbon sequestration?
No, go ahead. Go ahead. Please respond to Sammy.
Okay. I think she's exactly right that coal is. Not just because of renewables, but actually to a large extent because of natural gas and the fracking boom and the expansion of natural gas and the lower price of natural gas. That's probably at least 90% of the reason why there's a push away from coal. And so coal, unfortunately for people working in that industry, is on its way out. And we do need to take care of them and need to kind of realize that. In terms of jobs, the renewable energy and energy efficiency industry is much more efficient at creating jobs than the fossil fuel industry. So there are, around twice as many people working in the solar industry now, I think around 180,000, compared to the number of total coal miners in the U.S., and for every $1 million of contribution to GDP, the renewable energy and energy efficiency industry generates 2.5 to 9 times as many jobs as the fossil fuel industry. And to a large extent, that's because the fossil fuel industry has been around for so long and they've concentrated. They've been efficient in the sense of being able to generate revenue for executives and shareholders without having to have a lot of jobs created. So they've been, quote unquote, inefficient in that way. But it doesn't help on the man as much. But going to carbon sequestration, that's basically anytime you have plants growing in soil, as much as 50% of the carbon that's taken in through photosynthesis is sent down to feed soil microbes, bacteria, fungi, and other microbes in the soil. There's a symbiotic relationship between the above-ground plants and the below-ground soil microbes, and the microbes in turn make nutrients available to the plant roots. For example, there are nitrogen-fixing bacteria that make nitrogen available in an available form to plant roots, and there are other nutrients like calcium, magnesium, iron, etc., that are made available by various microbes in the soil. So some of that carbon that's delivered to these microbes in the form of carbohydrates, sugars, enzymes, eventually makes it through to a stable form called glomalin, which is created by mycorrhizal fungal networks that attach to plant roots. So, and this is carbon that's created in a stable form that allows us to sequester carbon in the long term, but also so the glomalin kind of holds together soil in these small aggregates, kind of like if you can visualize they're like cottage cheese. They hold together, but in between these aggregates, you get space for water and air to get through. And so along with getting carbon into soil, you increase water holding capacity, which is crucial because one of the consequences of climate change will be increased flooding in certain areas, increased drought in other areas. The more water you can hold in soil, the more you'll be resilient to both of these extremes. So for every 1% increase in soil organic matter, soil can hold 17,000 to 25,000 additional gallons of water per acre.
Okay. Could you talk a little bit about the jobs potential in the area of carbon sequestration?
Uh-huh.
And that is, again, carbon sequestration is the process, if I get it right, of taking sunlight and converting it to carbon, which is stored in the ground, right? It's taken out of the atmosphere and put into the ground. So what is the potential for this? And you go ahead and explain further if you like.
I guess I haven't looked at studies that look at the job creation potential, but in general, it will generally require getting away from large industrial chemical agriculture, so that the techniques that are involved tend to be more conducive to relatively smaller farms where the farmer is attuned to the land and aware of the
okay, I lost him. Martha Holdrich, you're on the line.
Yes, I am.
Okay, hold on one second. I've lost Sudhir in the process, and hopefully he'll call back in, and we can get him back on the line. But Martha Holdrich, thank you for calling in. I know that you are a retired cattle farmer, and you are into cattle grazing, and you learn things from your work that you have later. I'm going to try to get Sudhir back on the line. Hang on one second. Sudhir, are you on the line? Sudhir, are you on the line? All right, call back in, Martha, if I lose you.
All right, I will.
Yeah, I lost her. Okay, Sudhir, I've got you back on the line. I dropped you inadvertently, and Martha is calling in, and I'm trying to get the two of you on the line at the same time, having a little difficulty with it. But go ahead and continue your thought, and if you do get caught cut off again, just call me back.
Okay. I haven't looked at studies about the potential for jobs, but I believe that because it would require things to be done more locally and would require more manpower. I think it would be a job creator, this movement towards regenerative agriculture that builds soil and builds soil carbon. One example, so I was at the Grass-Fed Exchange Conference in late April in Georgia, and we visited Will Harris's White Oak Pastures. He has about 2,500 acres, and he's employing about 120 people over those, so about one per one person for every about 20 acres. And he's doing well, and he's employing a system called holistic management, which takes care of soil health, and it's actually there's more to it, but generally it's addressing soil health and soil carbon as part of it. And he's employing a good number of people, but he's also doing very well. He's able to pay them on average $36,000 per year, which is excellent in that area, where he's in Wolfton, Georgia, and getting full benefits and also being allowed to eat for half price, both themselves and employ his families.
Hang on one second.
Cafeteria.
So do you
he's doing very well in terms of taking care of his employees.
Hang on one second. I wanted to just see Martha's trying to call back in. I want to see if I've got her on the line. Martha, are you there? Martha, are you there? Oh, boy. Well, I'm having trouble getting the two of you on the line at the same time. Let me put you on hold, try to see if I can get Martha. Hang on. Well. Okay, Sidier, I'm back with you. Martha probably gave up on me and dropped.
Poor Martha.
I apologize. She's back on again, so I'm going to try again. Hang on. Martha, you on the line? Martha, you on the line?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, now I've got Sudhir on the other line, but I'm having trouble getting the two of you on the line at the same time. But let me see if it's going to work.
Well, perhaps I can do my experience piece first, and then Sudhir has many more science and statistics and that sort of thing to reinforce what I've been saying.
Okay, let's go ahead and do that. I hate to put Sudhir in that position he's holding, but I guess he'll call me back. So go ahead and talk about your experience as a farmer and as a cattle grazer, and what you learned from that, and what it means in terms of global warming.
Oh, I'm so happy to do that, and I like the name of your program, Seven Generations. That is really the way we need to think, seven generations at least, think about managing farmland. And so I began my life in managing farmland when I was already my husband is already near his retirement, and so now I'm a retired farmer. I'm not currently farming, but the experience is fresh in my mind, so I'm happy to share it with you.
Okay.
I had when I began, I had no farm experience and no agricultural education. My husband was in the Foreign Service of the State Department, and we had a life that was very different from farming. So we bought this farm in 1979 in Greenbrier County, West Virginia, and we bought it as a retreat. And then suddenly we had 106 acres in a mountainous area of West Virginia, and we had to think what to do with all this land. We couldn't just be retreating. We had to do something with it. So fortunately, I had been reading for some years in the Stockman Grass Farmer magazine, which comes once a month, and that also has references to books that are really important on regenerative agriculture and sustainable agriculture, which are nearly the same. Based on that information, but without much of any help from the local extension agent, I began in 2000, began rotational grazing, and organic management. That meant no chemical fertilizers and no pesticides, no herbicides, and it meant getting my nitrogen from clover. Then after a few years, we began doing soil tests at the University of West Virginia, as we sent our soil samples to the test lab at the University of West Virginia. And it came out in 1 5-year period that we had more than doubled our organic matter from 4.1% to 8.3%. Organic matter in the soil is about 57% carbon, and that carbon had come from the sky. So this was from the atmosphere. So this was a very unusual point of view, which the UN did not agree with at all. The United Nations climate negotiations did not agree with, and they still don't pay attention to it. But because my experience was so different from what the UN position was, I began to ask a lot of questions from whoever I thought could give me additional information. So I went to the Agricultural Research Service in Beltsville, Maryland, and they looked at my numbers of doubling organic matter in 5 years, and they thought it was quite high, but they didn't question it too much. But they invited me to go to their every 5 years planning session about climate change. And out of that came one ARS agent picked up my data sheet, and he telephoned me and said, "I think you have a net carbon sequestration." That means that there was more carbon sequestration than there was methane or nitrous oxide being emitted by the cattle or the land. And so then I just realized that the fact that I was organic and that I did daily rotations was really making a difference. So what actually happens? It's how does that carbon from CO2 in the atmosphere get into the soil? So it's photosynthesis is the answer. That to achieve the biochemical reaction of photosynthesis, you need sun for the power, you need CO2 in the air, you need some green plant matter, and you need some water, for rainwater preferably. So then the carbon will come down into the plant and into the grass and into the soil, both. So you have more carbon in the soil and a good, vigorous plant growth. So this process of photosynthesis works better with cattle plus management on grass than it does with any other system, primarily cropland. You can get some photosynthesis from cropland, but you get more when you combine the cattle with it, and you rotate the animals. If I present these ideas, I hold up my own hands. You can try holding up your own hands. Put your right hand out in front of you with your fingers pointing up, and your left hand beside it with your fingers pointing down. And the fingers pointing up represent the grass, and the fingers pointing down represent the roots of the grass. So what happens when you put cattle on the grasslands is that the cattle in the particular paddock that they're in, they eat off the grass, and then the root structure down below partially dies off, and that gets organic matter into the soil. So you can try that with your own hands.
We did. We did, Martha.
You might find it interesting. So I had the results I had was that the cattle gained well every year, and the other important result was that we produced a very healthful meat, which was very tasty, and I had it tested, and it tests very high in omega-3 fatty acids, which are the good fatty acids. Everybody needs both omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids, but it's better if you have the ratio about even. If you feed grain to cattle, you're going to get high omega-6s. If you let the cattle eat grass, you're going to have high omega-3s. Now, the other creature that eats grasses is a salmon. We all know how healthy salmon are, and they eat grasses underwater. So it's a pretty remarkable parallel. So I did a lot of eating of grass-fed beef, and I felt it was healthy for me and it was healthy for my customers. So I can also tell you about some other ideas that come not from my farm but from other research. But I think that's enough about my own farm. I think if you have Sudhir on the phone, maybe he can fill in more.
Well, I've asked Sudhir to call back in about 5 minutes because I haven't been successful in getting both of you on the line at the same time. So okay. What we'll do is spend another 5 minutes or so talking about your experience and what the implications are for that in terms of global warming. What does this mean for us if we think about the amount of grasslands that exist, and what is the potential for capturing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and putting it back into the soil?
Well, I can't tell you the exact numbers because every grasslands is different, every soil is different, every management system is different. But it is really important to notice that what I noticed was that my cattle kept gaining weight well when I was using this system. And I did this in the face of all the farms in the area where our farm was were using chemical fertilizers, and I was not. And so it was, financially beneficial. I didn't have to buy fertilizer. I was just managing the cattle right, so it pulled the carbon out of the air. And if we can get less CO2 in the air, that should be a benefit to our climate.
And what is the actual practice that you follow? It's called management intensive grazing. Now, why does that result in capturing more carbon dioxide from the air? What is it about management intensive grazing that has this benefit to it?
Well, it's that you move the cattle. In my case, I moved them every day because that was a convenient time frame in which to move the cattle. So I tried to explain with my hand illustration what happens is the cattle eat off the grass leaves, and then the roots will partially die back to balance the loss of leaves, and those roots make organic matter in the soil. And that organic matter has come from the photosynthesis process. That's a miraculous bit of nature that photosynthesis works. And if people manage right, that is management intensive grazing, if you manage it right, then you can increase the natural photosynthesis.
And how long does the grass remain fallow? How long is it until you go back to a pasture that you have vacated? How long does it, and it seems to be important that the grass has time to recover.
Yes, it should grow to about 6 or 8 inches. Some systems say 8 or 10 inches or more. That's what we tried to use, 6 or 8 inches, and then you eat the grass. The cattle eat the grass down about half of it, so 2 or 3 inches, and depends on the type of grass how short you can eat it, but 2 to 4 inches is about right, and then you take the cattle out and you put them in the next paddock. And oh, they're so happy to move. It's so easy to manage cattle when you do it this way with rotational grazing. You go down near to the cattle, and they come close to you, and they're just you open the gate and they go right through, and they're thrilled to have fresh grass that has been growing for 2 or 3 or 4 weeks, depending on the climate, the rainfall, the temperature, all those things as to when you move them back in.
Sounds great. You have happy cows, you got a happy farmer, and you got a happy planet.
Yes.
So everybody wins on that situation.
You're so right.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you, Martha. I wish I could have you all on the line at the same time, but something I'm missing here. So I'm going to let you go, and I appreciate very much your calling in and giving us this little bit of insight into your experience. And then I'll try to get Sudhir back on the line, and we'll continue with this conversation.
All right. Well, if you can't get him on the line, just call me back.
Okay.
And I can tell you about the French proposal to back up what the UN is doing about reducing emissions, and the French have an idea about pulling carbon out of the air and improving food security and climate, and then there's lawns we can talk about, lawns and parks and that sort of thing. So there are other ideas we can bring up.
Okay, thank you, Martha.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Hello? Hello?
Hi, Joe.
Sudhir, you're on the line.
Sudhir!
I don't know. I sent you a couple of messages. I don't know if you got them. But anyway, I've had trouble keeping both of you on the line at the same time.
Oh, okay.
So I just...
Yeah, I could hear Martha, but
you could.
I had a hard time hearing you, unfortunately.
Weird. Okay. Well, I'm glad you can hear Martha so you know where she was going. And do you want to take off on that a little bit and talk about it from your perspective?
Sure. So, I mean, what in particular did you have in mind?
Well, I'm really interested in the impact of all of this and what are the potentials, not only for cattle grazing, but for other methods of sequestering carbon. Because, you know, we've talked a lot about changing our methods of taking carbon out of the ground, and kind of terminating that practice or cleaning up our act quite a bit. But I don't think we as a nation, as a people, have talked a lot about putting the carbon back in the soil and what that means for us and what the potential is on a worldwide scale for putting the carbon back in the ground.
You're exactly right. There's not been that much attention paid to the potential for soil to draw carbon through photosynthesis to be a carbon sink. So the estimates in terms of the potential are varied. You know, some estimates are very conservative, and some are extremely hopeful. So some calculations that the DC chapter had Philip Bogdanoff came up with. So he estimates that, or he was looking at estimates on cropland, grazing land, and wetlands also, and you know, taking into account the total amount of land and if we use best management practices, and he was using fairly conservative estimates according to what we've come across in terms of those who believe in the power of, or talk about biological versus geological soils. But I guess that's another deeper topic that maybe for another time. But basically, he estimated that we could, if we did everything right, we could not only sequester all of the all of current human emissions, but we could, beyond that, take about 7.5 parts per million out of the atmosphere into the soil, and get to about 200 a level of 280 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere in about 16 years.
And
you know,
we're
again, assuming best management practices
and we're
on
at
all
about,
that land.
We're at about 400 now, right?
Now, that's not from any published article, you know, in a peer-reviewed journal. Some of the estimates that I've heard are, I think we could sequester about maybe 30 to 40% of the carbon in the, or of human emissions per year for about maybe 30 years. So the estimates are varied, but there is definitely indications that there's a quite a lot of potential there.
Okay, so this gives us some hope that if we can get the wheels turning, and actually there's most of this that we've talked about has to do with grasslands, but I guess it also has to do with any form of vegetation that can capture and put into the ground. But there's something peculiar about grasslands that make them a very viable alternative for this, and it has to do with animal grazing, right?
Yes. There's also a lot of potential on cropland, you know, in terms of using moving towards no-till and incorporating cover crops with diverse cover crops. So there's a lot of potential on cropland as well, but grassland. You know, herbivores like cattle naturally evolved or co-evolved with grasslands, and there's you know once again a symbiotic relationship. Herbivores like cattle obviously need grass, but the grass, it turns out, also needs cattle and other herbivores like sheep and goats for the maximum growth and health of the grass. As long as these herbivores are managed appropriately in a way, and so the management that Alan Savory of Zimbabwe has come up with called holistic planned grazing, it mimics how these herbivores evolved together with predators, and so the predators force the herds to move periodically, and the movement, you know, from paddock to paddock, mimics that predator motivated movement, and gets back to the kind of health and growth of grasslands we had in the wild, for example, in the West with the buffalo.
Yeah, could you talk about the buffalo? And I think that's very very illustrative of what the potential and how it works.
So in the West, we had very deep rooted grasses that were naturally maintained by the buffalo, the combination of the buffalo and the movement induced by their predators that forced them to move. Unfortunately, so the Dust Bowl, for example, was caused by, to a large extent, by moving away from grasslands to planting in the West, wheat and other and corn and other crops that were not as deep rooted, and in a time of drought, didn't hold on to the soil as well, and allowed the situation to occur where you had the Dust Bowl situation. So it was the movement away from buffalo, the killing of buffalo, and also the movement towards row crop agriculture that depleted the soil and created this a situation where the Dust Bowl could occur.
I think
so the potential is great to go back to the way soil, which was very, very rich in carbon. I've heard estimates of 10 to 15% soil organic matter, whereas now many of the crop land that we're using has as low as 1% soil organic matter. So there's a lot of potential to using these practices to get back organic matter into soil, where it can do good, not just in terms of climate change, but in terms of increasing water holding capacity of the soil, reducing soil erosion, reducing leakage of pesticides and fertilizers into watersheds where they cause pollution and can lead to dead zones, algae blooms. So there are a lot of co-benefits, even if we leave aside the climate change benefits.
And when you talk about these things, it really becomes important. I think it's sometimes counterintuitive. People think, well, the grasses grow. If you put animals on there to graze the grasses, you're destroying the vegetation. But there's an entire cycle here that includes the importance of the predators of the herbivores. And without the whole package, it doesn't work. So either humans have got to get in there and manage the movement of the herbivores to produce this effect, or you go back to reintroducing the predators, and they will manage it for us.
So I haven't heard much work done on reintroduction of predators and the impact. The positive impact that can have on grass production, that's another thing to possibly look into. But I guess I also want to say that there's a lot of possibility for on cropland. Using no-till and cover crops. So, for example, David Johnson out of New Mexico State University, he has what's called a year-long intensive production, basically cover cropping program, where he's been able to sequester 15 tons of carbon dioxide per acre per year there in Las Cruces, New Mexico. And he feels that it's actually just the carbon sequestration is actually just increasing because he hasn't even reached the peak yet. So he estimates that if this kind of system were incorporated in 17% of the world's croplands, that could sequester all of human-caused carbon emissions, yearly caused carbon emissions. Now, once again, the question is, is that system appropriate for all lands? Some areas have monsoon, where you only have water coming in, 4 months out of the year, and how practical is it to implement the system everywhere? That's those are questions that have to be asked. But the raw potential seems to be quite large, and that has to be definitely looked into.
Well, this sounds like an area that really is an emerging bit of hope for mankind in terms of our ability to cope with this mess we've made of the atmosphere. And there's some very practical solutions. So this is something that I would like to continue to monitor on my radio show, and I'd like to invite you, Sudhir, to assist me in that effort. So we'll continue this conversation, and that's kind of wraps up our time for today, but thank you very much for coming on and bringing this important topic to us, and I look forward to future conversations in this vein.
Oh, thank you so much, Joe. Definitely look forward to continuing this this conversation.
Okay, well, thank you, Sudhir, and take care. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Thanks. You too.
Yeah, bye-bye. Okay, Sammy, thank you for hanging in there with me.
Of course,
all this
Joe.
Time.
I took notes and everything. This was fascinating, actually.
It is. I mean, for me, it just offers so much hope. So many things that we can do, things that people can do locally. I mean, this has implications for even cutting your lawn, mm-hmm. how you go about doing that. It's just very, very important. And it really gets into how everything fits together in nature and how we as humans can use our intelligence to get things back to a system that works.
Yeah, get back to balance. I like that. I like that. Like I said, Joe, I actually took notes because it's really cool to implement some environmentally and agriculturally friendly things as we go in our activism locally. So I'm excited. That was amazing.
Absolutely. You're listening to WSHC Shepherdstown. That concludes Seven Generations Radio for the day. So I'll be back in a couple of weeks, and we'll do it again. Thank you very much for listening.